Welcome to the Peace and Violence essay portion of Sunstone West. This is actually where all the cool kids are, just to let you know. All those polygamy people over there. So we're going to be focusing on the essay that talked about Mormonism's relationship with peace and violence. And we're going to have a great panel. We're going to be hearing from Joanna Brooks, Morris Thurston, and Amanda Farr Knickerbocker. And since we don't have a table, and tables are so nice to lean on while you're listening, they're just going to stay in the audience, and then for the discussion, they're going to come up. So during the presentations, they're going to stay where they're at and come up and give their presentation here. So let me quickly introduce you to these fine folks. Joanna Brooks is the Associate Dean of Graduate and Research Affairs at San Diego University. She's the author of The Book of Mormon Girl, A Memoir of an American Faith, co-editor of the forthcoming Mormon Feminism, 40 Years of Essential Writings from Oxford, and Decolonizing Mormonism from the University of Utah. We also get to hear from Amanda Farr Knickerbocker, who has a degree in educational sciences with an emphasis in biology, chemistry, and physics. Holy cow, that's a lot of emphases. I could barely make it through one of those. She lives in San Diego with her husband and five children, three of whom are foster children. She is a support group leader for foster parents of medically fragile, drug-exposed, and HIV-positive children in San Diego. And then we're going to be hearing from Morris Thurston, who is a graduate of the Harvard Law School, a retired partner of the global law firm Latham & Watkins, a former consultant to the Joseph Smith Papers in the legal series, and a board member of the Dialogue Foundation, who just announced Boyd Peterson as the new editor of Dialogue, which I think is fantastic. Yay! His paper, The Boggs Shooting and Attempted Extradition, Joseph Smith's most famous case, received an award of merit from the Mormon History Association. So we'll go in that order.
Actually, we're not.
Oh, we're going to start with the handsomest one first.
That's what I was going to say. What is this thing? Is this the...
Yeah,
you guys are... You guys are really first class. Here you go. Well, it's great to see so many of you stayed after hearing Brad explain that nobody really cared about the Mountain Meadows Massacre and everyone cared about polygamy. But I don't have time for a lot of stuff here. None of us do. And so I'm going to kind of tell some stories for the most part.
I apologize. I need to grab this real quick because I'm going to...
Because you're going to go to the other room? Let me know. As a people, we Mormons have long had a persecution complex. This is not unusual among minority groups, many of whom have endured great suffering because of their faith. Our Mormon persecution narrative centers around our people having been driven by violent mobs out of Ohio and Missouri and finally Illinois, all because of our peculiar religious beliefs, or so we've been told. Today, Mormons have political and financial power in America far beyond our numbers and are willing to use it, as we saw in the church's victorious Prop 8 battle. This has not seemed to affect our ability to play the persecution card, however, as just this week one of the brethren explained with an apparent straight face that because of, quote, retaliation and boycotts, end quote, in the wake of Prop 8, quote, we were really the victims. I didn't know that at the time of Prop 8 that we were the victims. The church's essay on peace and violence aligns itself to this narrative. I'll focus on the first part of the essay, which deals mostly with the wrongs done to the Mormons in Missouri and Illinois. But I want to give some credit where credit is due. If you read past the many paragraphs dealing with the terrible things that happened to the saints in Missouri, you will find this sentence tucked away at the end of a paragraph. Quote, in the beginning of this extended persecution, some of the saints, beginning in 1838, responded on some occasions with defensive and at times retaliatory actions of their own. So I guess that's an important acknowledgement. The essay also breaks new ground by acknowledging that in Missouri, some leaders and members organized a paramilitary group known as the Danites, whose objective was to defend the community against dissidents and excommunicated Latter-day Saints, as well as other Missourians. And it goes on to explain that we don't really know how much Joseph Smith knew or was briefed about the Danites, but it does acknowledge that he was aware of them and apparently approved of them, at least their organization. Obviously, much has to be left out of an essay like this. And I don't really fault the original authors, who I'm sure are historians employed by the Church History Department at BYU, or at BYU. For one thing, whatever they wrote originally had to be vetted by a committee of several apostles in the 70s, so we don't really know what they might have written had they had an entirely free hand. But since I am, as I mentioned, a storyteller at heart, I thought it might be interesting to shed light on a few things that either are not mentioned or glossed over. Regarding the Danites, it's true we don't know how much Joseph was briefed, but we do know that his journal contains this entry for July 27, 1838. Quote, "We have a company of Danites in these times to put to rights physically that which is not right, and to cleanse the church of very great evils, which hath hitherto existed among us, inasmuch as they cannot be put to right by teachings and persuasions." In other words, we're going to use our power, our physical power, to get rid of these folks if we can't convince them to stay in the church. This doesn't happen today, physically, but there are other coercions and problems that are somewhat reminiscent of this, I think. One of the most outspoken of the Danite firebrands was Sidney Rigdon, then a counselor to Joseph Smith, who on July 4, 1838, in an impassioned Independence Day oration at Far West, Missouri, said, "We take God and all the holy angels to witness this day that we warn all men in the name of Jesus Christ to come on us no more forever. The mob that comes on us to disturb us, it shall be between us and them a war of extermination, for we will follow them till the last drop of blood is spilled, or else they will have to exterminate us, for we will carry the seat of war to their own houses and their own families, and one part or the other shall be utterly destroyed." Well, Rigdon was a firebrand, but that's the kind of rhetoric that seems constantly to have gotten us into trouble and sort of argues a little bit against the victim narrative that we like to tell. Of course, Governor Boggs echoed the word exterminate later in his infamous extermination order against the Mormons, and this just happened a few months later. The essay doesn't mention as well the Gallatin Election Day battle a few months later on August 6, 1838. At the polling place, one of the candidates for state legislature began accusing the Mormons of being horse thieves and robbers, which may have been true, and urged the people to bar them from the election place. I love how John Low Butler, later to become Bishop of Spanish Fork, described the scuffle that followed. "There was Riley Stewart, Hiram Nelson, and myself." By the way, he was from Kentucky, so if I sort of lapse into a mountain dialect. "And another man that I can't think of his name just now, but we all started to go and put on our votes. I was about the last one, and the brother that was on ahead got knocked down. And then Brother Riley Stewart interfered for him, and one of the mob rushed at him with a knife. Riley turned and ran, and when he saw the man, he draw his knife. I then ran over to the ruffian. As it happened, I saw an oak stick lying in the road. It was split, one of those sticks that they have to build chimneys with. And just as the fellow struck Stewart, I struck him. And as I struck him, there had been another fellow running after me with a loaded horsewhip and struck me right between the shoulders. Just as the fellow struck me, I turned around and struck an underhanded lick and fetched it under his chin and broke his jaw in two places, and down he came. And we had no more trouble with him. There was so much excitement after that that I could hardly tell what did transpire. But one of the brethren had a large cotton handkerchief full of earthenware teacups and saucers, and some fellow broke some of them with a stick. And he then made a weapon of them and commenced breaking the rest of them over the heads. I know that I knocked them right and left, every one that came in my reach, and I know there were over 8 or 10. There was one fellow commenced bawling when he saw one of his companions lie motionless on the sod. A brother hearing the poor fellow wailing for his compassion thought he would give him something else to cry for. He came up with a rock and threw at him and struck him right in the mouth. He boo-hooed and cried out what damned hard licks those damned Mormons do hit. Then they commenced carrying off the men that had been knocked down, and some killed, and some were standing up against the fence and against the house with the blood running from their heads and faces, and I expect that some of them were from the effects of the teacups and saucers. However, they looked pitiful objects indeed, and when it was all over, Brother Voris looked at the crockery ware, and there was not a piece left the size of an inch, and the handkerchief and all was covered with blood. I like that description because it just seems so immediate and true. I'm wondering what Brother Voris's wife thought about her teacups and crockery being used in that fashion. I'm going to skip over. I've written quite a bit about Joseph Smith in Illinois and some of the statements that he made there that were likewise rather violence inciting. I guess I'd like to just quote one from a speech that he gave in the Grove at Nauvoo after having escaped from being sent back to Missouri to face persecution for allegedly having participated in the Missouri War. This is what he said at that occasion. He said a lot of things like this, but I've just picked out this one. Before I will bear this unhallowed persecution any longer, before I will be dragged away again among my enemies for trial, I will spill the last drop of blood in my veins and will see all my enemies in hell. To bear it any longer would be a sin, and I will not bear it any longer. Shall we bear it any longer? At this we're told that one universal no ran through all the vast assembly like a loud peal of thunder. There's one other thing I'd like to talk about, another story I'd like to tell before I sit down. This one, the essay mentions the Mormons' relationship with Native Americans. And to its credit, it acknowledges that even though Brigham Young pursued a peace policy, it emerged unevenly and was inconsistently applied. And then they're told a story about a Native American named Old Bishop who was murdered by the Mormons. And the essay acknowledges that in these instances and others, some Latter-day Saints committed excessive violence against Native peoples. The essay doesn't mention at all the Black Hawk War, which occurred 15 or 20 years after this. But as I was researching a biography of my great-great-grandfather, Torah Thurston, I came across some information in the church archives that I found fascinating because it really hadn't been fully explored anywhere, and most of the history books that I found just didn't mention it at all. My great-great-grandfather helped settle Circleville in 1855-54, and by 1856, there had been some Indian troubles there. Black Hawk's warriors had attacked. But all during this 2 or 3 year period they lived there, there was a tribe of peaceful Paiute Indians that lived right next to them, and it traded back and forth, and it never caused any particular problem. But on this one occasion, and there were some extenuating circumstances, there had been some attacks in other areas near Circleville. The message came that they had better take care of their Indians, because if they didn't, they might have some trouble. So the men of Circleville all went out dark night one night and surrounded the little Indian encampment. And we're talking maybe 20, 25 people, so it was not a large group, a tribe. Took them all into custody and basically talked them into coming back to their meeting house and staying there. They told the Indians that they could keep their weapons. That would be a problem, but they need to have a talk, need to have a powwow. So they got back, and while they were there in the room, at a prearranged signal, that the settlers outnumbered the Indians by about 3-1. The settlers grabbed each Indian, three people, and pinned them and took away their weapons. And then they were going to hold them prisoner until they could figure out what to do with them. Well, unfortunately, that night, and this included not only men but women and children, that night a couple of them tried an escape and were shot doing it. Well, the settlers panicked. This is reminiscent of Mountain Meadows. What do we do now? We've killed a couple of Indians. We can't let them go. We can't really ever let them go because they'll bring back Black Hawk and his hordes, which I don't even know if that would have happened because it was a completely different tribe. And so this is what I wrote in my biography about that, again, taken primarily from the Circleville Ward history. This is what was decided they would do. And this was after complete discussion with the presiding elder of the area and certainly some discussion back and forth. Except for the Indian children, each of the prisoners was led one by one out of the meeting house and around to the east end, where a man stood prepared with a club and knocked each of them in the head, one after another. As each Indian was struck, he or she was stunned, and the next thing done was the cutting of their throats by a man who stood prepared to do this with a large, sharp knife. The settlers carried the dead bodies into a cellar, which they had intended for a mill, threw the bodies in and filled it over with dirt. About 5 children were spared, the oldest being a 12-year-old boy. The next day, after further consultation, it was determined that the boy also was a danger to the settlement, and he too was killed. The younger children were adopted into families of the settlers. And I ran across a descendant of one of those children, and so there, some of them are still members of the church even today. That's not something that is talked about a lot, but it happened, and I don't think we should forget it. It wasn't the opinions of the church leaders were mixed at the time when they found out about it. Apostle Orson Hyde, who continued to hold hawk-like views toward the war in general, wrote to Apostle George A. Smith that the Paiutes in Circleville have received the kind of gospel which they merit. Scoffing at any suggestion that the Paiutes might not have been hostile, Hyde said that he did not know where to find any friendly Indians in Utah. 10 years later, with the benefit of hindsight, Brigham Young stated that the curse of God still rested upon Circle Valley because a band of our Lamanite brethren and their families here were cruelly slain. So I'd like to conclude now. I've kind of told my stories with three thoughts that occurred to me as I was preparing for this. First, I feel that we have to resist the attitude that church leaders, like apostles that we're talking about in these stories, are always right, even if they're not, and that it's our duty to follow them. According to John Corll, during the Missouri period, it was the imperative duty of the church to obey the word of Joseph Smith or the presidency without question or inquiry, and that if there were any that would not, they should have their throats cut from ear to ear. Today, there's no literal cutting of throats, but we who were living in California during Prop 8 and opposed to it understand how dissidents were treated. And the same, they continue to be treated badly today, whether the issue of same-sex marriage or a woman's role in the church. How am I doing time-wise? Great, I'm going to finish early then. I'll just mention that as many of you know, we have been active in the Miller-Eckel Study Group in Orange County. For the past 10 years, we've hosted them in our home, and we had our first meeting ever at the Fullerton Institute building in January, which is going to be our new venue. And it's kind of tricky because in that we do like to discuss issues in that meeting, and we knew that it was going to be tricky, and our first speaker was Nyland McBain, who really isn't that controversial, and has written a book that said very things about women in the church, many of which have been adopted by the church leaders, so we thought we'd be okay. There were a few comments during Q&A from people who supported the ordained women movement, and apparently there were those in the group that could not abide the fact that someone would have an opposing view on that kind of issue, and they went behind our backs to the institute director at Fullerton, who's a member of a local stake presidency, and complained. Well, we're still meeting there. We hope that things have been smoothed over. But it kind of shows you how things in the church, and we all know this, I mean, I'm certainly preaching to the choir to a degree, how it's difficult to have a true conversation about things. And if anything that this history of our violence has shown us is that conversations are the right thing to have and not violence, whether it be violence physically or violence in the sense of expelling dissidents from our group and not hearing voices that might disagree with ours. And then that brings me to my third takeaway, which is when we're wrong, as history shows we often have been, we shouldn't be afraid to retract erroneous statements and to apologize. Elder Oaks says that the word apology is not in the Bible, but I don't think we're just limited to using words that are in the Bible. In our era, corporations are often found responsible for things that their employees do, and they often apologize for things their employees do, even though the CEO may not have known about it at the time. And I don't think that would hurt us to do that. I'm not sure why we have such an aversion to apologizing. Perhaps our leaders fear that if they set a precedent, a future generation of church leaders might be apologizing for their actions today. And perhaps they're right. Thank you.
All right. Is this how this thing works? All right. I'm Amanda. Feel free to go see the polygamy talk right now. I don't know if you've heard of this lady, but in April of 2014, Joanna Brooks, she spoke at the Sunstone Navigating the Borderlands conference. And I was not able to attend. I had been planning on it, but a week before it happened, we welcomed our youngest foster daughter into our family. And while as a foster parent, I can't and won't divulge the circumstances that brought her into foster care or the particulars of her very personal situation, we can assume that her story is similar to many, many other foster children across the United States. Things such as drugs, violence, neglect, fear, and distrust litter the files of social workers across America. That is to say that violence and peace are not unique to the Latter-day Saints. And unfortunately, it's a human experience and one that is repeated in all of our lives. But today I want to talk about recognizing the patterns of violence, particularly violence that is socially accepted. The things that are discussed in this essay are things that were accepted either by members of the church or that community or by members of the community in Missouri and Illinois and other places. Socially, whatever violence was perpetrated was something that one side or the other socially accepted. So what makes generally good, God-fearing people commit such savage acts? And finally, how can we evaluate our own actions to see the ways we perpetuate violence in our communities? Back to that Joanna Brooks lady. I was watching the video from the Navigating Borderlands conference and heard her say this. She said, quote, "Our bureaucratic correlated curriculum has kept Mormons innocent to our own history and to the richer dimensions of our own theology," end quote. I thought a lot about that statement and how it applies not just to my relationship with the church, but also in my own life. How do I correlate my experiences so that I'm kept innocent in my storyline? I've thought about how it applies to these essays we're discussing today. As the essays have come out pretty much universally in the Bloggernacle, we've had this response where people say, almost, really close, but that's going to be a big nope. And as a church, we continue to keep ourselves innocent to our own history. And inevitably, we miss out on what could be tremendous growth, which is why we're here today, right? To break that innocence and to sit in that uncomfortable place where we realize that our past, our present, and our future are all strikingly similar. I have a therapist that we work with the foster children, who insists that we all sit in our discomfort, which personally I hate. But as a group, I think, you know, we should try this. Before we can understand or even acknowledge the patterns of violence, we have to have an accurate view of what comes before. We cannot recognize patterns if all we see is a correlated version of events. To truly see, we have to look. In reading the Peace and Violence Among 19th Century Latter-day Saints essay, I was struck with how strong the patterns of socially accepted violence are. Essentially, we have a strong leader, whether it is a secular leader or a religious leader, who uses strong and provocative but vague language, which otherizes a group or a type of people. This message is then internalized by local leaders who, in an effort to be the best, most righteous, most wonderful, most patriotic people, then hyperbolize that message and go to an extreme in trying to enforce a strong but vague message. Local leaders crack down, and it leaves the general community feeling either afraid or anxious to be not in that group. We see this all throughout our Mormon history. In the secular political side, we see a governor or a senator or whomever start speaking about the evils of polygamy and starts discussing how it's the same thing as slavery and how these people are coming to steal your daughters and to take these people away. And regardless of whatever guilt members of the church had in that kind of conversation, that is what communities heard from their leadership. So we have Hans Mill, and we have Tar and Feathering, and we have a plethora of heartbreaking and terrifying stories that early saints experienced. Regardless of what their role in that violence was, they still experienced extreme violence. We have Brigham Young, who speaks on the importance of spilling your blood to atone for your sins, which, disturbing doctrine for sure, was also hyperbolic language, which served to either frighten members of the church into obedience or scare non-Mormons out of the area. So we have events like the Mountain Meadows Massacre, where men and women and children were not just killed, but tortured in a calculated and frankly horrific way. And then we have today, which is why we're here, right? Because we want to be able to change that narrative. We want to be able to shape Mormonism in a different way so we are not participating, so that our future does not have this same past. As far as I know, aside from torture on the national level, Mormons are rarely engaging in acts of socially accepted mass violence. But we do engage in significant acts of emotional violence. Leaders use adamant, yet still vague, language on the role of women in church, in society, in our homes, in the community, and in local leaders then engage in acts that go overboard, and the local community isolates and ostracizes those who fall outside the norm. When are you having a baby? When are you getting married? Why do you still work? When are you staying home after you have the baby? How could you do that? Don't you want to raise your own children? We go through and we question and we ask and we push until everybody looks just like that strong and vague language that we hear. Leaders speak on the sacredness of the family, protecting the family at all costs. And local leaders fear showing support for their LGBT congregants. It is not that, in the most part, those leaders don't love them, but they are afraid to come out in support of their members. Because of this vague language that we hear, nobody wants to be part of that group that has been otherized and has been pushed out. We hear things on the dangers of pornography addiction, and local leaders tell their congregations that those who engage in pornography are selfish and cruel and sinful, and those individuals are shamed and isolated. But it's not just Salt Lake, is it? We have bloggers who have researched and studied Mormonism who sometimes imply that those who are still those conservative, solid Mormons are somehow ignorant and clueless and just don't know what's going on. We speak over and over again how glad we are that we know all these things, and oh, I couldn't go back to that because I'm so much better now that I have this knowledge. We are so proud of ourselves for being separate from that anti-woman, anti-progressive, anti-gay rights. And those who are trying to learn but trying to stay in don't have a space. And we otherize them. It's recognizing this pattern that allows us to change how we react. It allows us to change how we respond, how we engage, and how we treat others. It allows us to stop this cycle of violence. As a foster parent and as a foster parent mentor, I see a lot of cycles of violence. I see children who have been beaten and skulls fractured and cannot walk, cannot eat, cannot even be recognized as human beings. I have seen cases of children who have been legitimately tortured for years. And as a mentor for foster parents, when a child comes into custody, I meet with foster parents typically at the hospital and go over the resources that they can engage in for this child in the community. And so a lot of times you have very scared foster parents who have this drug-exposed or HIV-positive child, and they don't know where to start, and they see this child who has been physically beaten to beyond recognition. But those children, the ones who are physically beaten, are the ones who usually do really well. There are so many resources, and if you have good foster parents and a good social worker and good community programs for biological parents, those people have wonderful outcomes. And it is beautiful to see the healing that can happen after such terrible physical violence. It's the children who are isolated, neglected, and unloved that have the worst outcomes. If a child doesn't make a connection with anyone, a doctor, a babysitter, a therapist, a teacher, a parent, a sibling, a neighbor, within the first 6 months of life, that's something that they typically struggle with for the rest of their lives. They will either be running to or from relationships forever without very intensive therapy. One of the first cases that brought us into foster care was my husband is a pediatrician, and he was working on the ward, which is the general floor for pediatrics. And there was a 3-year-old boy who was found carrying his 1-year-old sister through the street at like 2 a.m. And a car stopped and said, "What are you doing? Like, where are you going?" And he said, "I've got to get her out of there. I can't let her stay there." And That was about the age of our biological children, so it really hit home. We watched these kids as this little three-year-old came over as his sister was brought up from the ER, and he's petting her arm saying, "It's okay, I'm here now, I'll protect you. I'm so sorry I didn't keep her from you." It's those children who have not made good and lasting relationships with a caregiver, with somebody who is supposed to protect them, that struggle the most. One of the most tragic cases I've ever worked on was a case of severe neglect. This child spent 3 years in a closet and basically had no contact with the outside world. She came into custody and had no language, no self-help skills, no ability to attach. And I just saw her last week, almost 2 years later, and her foster family told me that she had just spoken her first words. She was 5 years old. But that is what isolation does to the brain. When we ostracize and otherize and shove out, that is what we do to the brain. We isolate and we do real damage. In my very non-professional opinion, it is the worst kind of violence we can engage in. We have to recognize this cycle, this pattern, and reject that correlated history that we've been given, because we cannot change the way we interact, the way we engage in our communities, unless we recognize that pattern and see how we are part of it. We are not exempt from that kind of violence, even if we feel as though it's violence that has been bestowed upon us as well. The fact is that people who experience violence often perpetrate violence as well. This is how we learn from these essays. Today we're talking about how these essays shape modern Mormonism, how they change the dialogue that we have in our communities and in our ward buildings and in secular Mormonism or intellectual Mormonism or otherwise. But for those who adhere to what we call our baptismal covenants, it is rejecting this pattern of violence. That is how we mourn with those who mourn and comfort those who stand in need of comfort, regardless of what side of Mormonism they find themselves on. We have to be the people who change this dynamic, whether it is progressive Mormons feeling ostracized, or it is those who are trying to learn history and find a place in the church who feel otherized. We have to come together and realize that we are in this together and we cannot perpetuate this cycle of violence. We can refuse to engage. We can be the comfort and we can create a climate where that's the only acceptable action. I've seen this happen where families who engaged in horrific acts of violence, and you think, how could they possibly reunify after doing this? But I have seen it happen, and I have seen it work, and it is the most beautiful thing you will ever be able to experience. And I know that that's something that we can see here in Mormonism as well, that we can change our correlated history into real history, which means we can change our correlated future into a real unified future. That is how we make change, and that is how we begin to shape modern Mormonism.
Was making a little symbol that wasn't very... There's an image here, I saw. Uh-oh, where's Kaini? Can you help me? It's his computer. Like to sleep?
Yeah.
These things happen.
Yeah, like...
I did. Oh, the power button. That would have been a good idea. Wake up? Okay, it'll wake up. It'll get there.
Yeah.
While I was waking up, I just want to thank you all for being here. It's so good to see so many dear faces I've known for many years. It's always an honor to participate in these important conversations about the life of the Mormon people. Thanks. And also to share this session with Maury and Amanda, who I admire deeply as people and as fellow laborers in the vineyard of liberal Mormonism. So ignore this. There's an image I don't want to think about yet that's just hiding behind the boring menu. But we'll get there.
Joanna.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's going to record you if you don't use the mic.
Oh, it'll record you fine.
Will
it? Yep.
Okay.
Thank you. Okay. I wanted to start with a general assessment of the article that we're all here to sort of think about, or at least use as a point of departure for thinking. And my scholarly training is in histories and cultural histories of race and colonialism in early America, so 16th, 17th, 18th, 19th centuries. And one thing I've always found very curious is the role, what I feel is the entirely outsized role the Mountain Meadows Massacre has played in discussions of Mormon history and the Mormon people, because there's nothing exceptional about the Mountain Meadows Massacre in the incredibly violent context of the colonization of the Americas and race slavery, except for that it was white-on-white violence. That's the only noteworthy thing, really, about it, I think, you know, when you just look at it in the context of the massive, massive endemic violence. So it's fascinating to me, the purchase it has on Mormon apologetics and on the non-Mormon imagination of Mormon people. So I'll say that one thing. And then the second thing, too, is someone who's done a lot of work in indigenous studies, I admire and I really appreciate the way the essay says, you know, acknowledges Mormon violence against indigenous peoples. But again, I wanted to see something we could have been even more robust. I think the story Maury told about the massacre. I mean, how many of these massacres are there in our history? And the sort of the isolated incidents of Mormon on indigenous violence that were cited really do nothing to acknowledge just how grossly and endemically violent all colonization is, and what, I mean, just massive violence of colonization. It's not that Mormons murdered one Indian. It's that we participated in the unsettling of indigenous civilizations that was just violent to its ground. So those are just two thoughts on the substance of the essay itself. But, you know, given that I'm not really a 19th century Mormon history expert, I wanted to comment mostly today on the article in light of its contemporary context, and the events of this last week and of the weeks to come highlight how important and how salient histories of violence and anti-Mormon violence and its consequences within the community are. We saw Elder Oaks's, you know, the statements and Elder Oaks's follow-up comments, mobilization of histories of anti-Mormon violence, you know, plugged into this LGBT context. And like Maury, I think we just need to acknowledge that in those comments by Elder Oaks were regrettable because they just weren't faithful to the facts of history. He's capable, certainly, of better, as is our tradition. And then also with the looming court of John DeLynn, I think some dynamics I'm going to talk about today, we see how important and salient knowing our history of violence is. But to that point, what really strikes me is the church's article, I think, is the product of an apologetics, a defensiveness, that as much exemplifies the interrelationship of violence against Mormon communities and within Mormon communities as it redresses them. Right? So the article as much exemplifies a violent cycle as it addresses violence. And I'll try and clarify this in more detail, especially when I show you the graphic, which we'll talk about. And my question, I guess, is what would it mean to move from a place where we are using Mormon history as the basic for an apologetics, a defensiveness, towards an ethics, or even towards a prophetic witness? You know, as these people with this history, we call on all humans to do X, would be a prophetic witness. So what would it mean to move beyond this sort of apologetic, defensive offering of our own history to using our history as a basic for an ethics or a prophetic witness? And this ethical move is the important work Jean England did, and that is still being done in the lecture series on peace named after him that's convened annually at UVU. And I want to highlight and celebrate Patrick Mason's fine work on Mormons and violence and peace in terms of national and international policy. But I want to take a moment and look at how Jean theorized violence in LDS communities and suggest that we need to press deeper into understanding how violence works in our communities in order to really move from an apologetics to an ethics and a redressing of violence. So I went back to Making Peace, and if you don't have Making Peace, you should own Making Peace, and you should read it, and Signature Books is out there, and I'm sure they can help you get your copy, which is a book that was really carved out within this moment of tensions between Mormon intellectuals and the church in the 90s, much like the one we're in now. And in his first essay, Making Peace, Eugene uses the theorist René Girard to talk about violence. And he theorizes it this way. He says, violence is the product of when two groups compete for similar resources and similar outcomes. And so one group commits an offense against the other in this process of escalating competition. And that the sacrifice of Jesus Christ redresses this or sort of neutralizes this escalation of violence when Christ offers himself as a sacrifice, revealing the cost of violence and the violence inherent in both parties, right? So Christ offers himself as a sacrifice, revealing both the violence of Jews who betrayed him and the Roman system. And everyone then, in the example of Jesus Christ, has a reason to reflect on their own capacity for violence and to repent of it. And then to sort of abandon competition for cooperation and an ethic of mercy. And I think this is a beautiful, and Jean, of course, pursues it through Shakespeare as well and shows how Shakespeare teaches about us about revenge and the revenge cycle. And this, of course, is important and poignant. But I think there is actually a dynamic more particular to Mormonism, one rooted in our own particular history, the history that the Church's Topics essay addresses and continues to be caught up in at the same time. And I want to think about this with you today. It's something I've been thinking a lot about and talking a lot about. Okay, did we... Okay, you left just in time. Oh, there it is. Okay. And, you know, this is an idea, some ideas I've been working on and sewing through some of my work, but it's certainly open to and welcome to feedback and additional help. So what I see is that our history, there's this cycle, a cycle of violence that interlinks the violence Mormons have had committed against them, the Mormons we commit against each other, the violence we commit against the outside world. So we can sort of see start at any point, but let's just start with the non-LDS world. Criticism, caricature, othering, antagonism, shaming of Mormons, which leads to a reaction on the part of the LDS base, retrenchment, militancy, withdrawal from civic conversation or civil conversation or dialogue, and a dynamic I call undergrounding, which I talk about at length in an essay that's coming out in Jana Reese's forthcoming Mormonism in American Politics, which is going to be, I hope, a good volume, but I call it undergrounding, and it's a term I use, I draw from our history of polygamy, but I use it especially to talk about dynamics throughout our political history when we tell the outside world one story and to protect our inside story, which we never do. But in the essay in Janet's book, I use it specifically in terms of our involvement in Prop 8, which had a similar dynamic in our ERA activism, that, you know, we are just concerned citizens who are just concerned in this issue rather than people participating in a very specifically orchestrated effort. We're just out here, don't tell them when you go door to door that you're Mormons canvassing for Prop 8. You're just an activist. Who cares about the family, about marriage? So I call this dynamic undergrounding. So this, we're going to tell the outside world one story while we harbor our, the story that we need to in order to protect what we perceive to be our distinctive theology and way of life. Retrenchment leads then to in-group microviolence, and I think microviolence is something we desperately need to think about in our community. Amanda referred to it. You know, another way is violence is endemic in our daily lives. I think microviolence among Mormon women needs to be thought about. Mormon women have thought a lot of time, spent a lot of time thinking about, you know, violence of patriarchy, but there is an intense level of microviolence among Mormon women, microaggression that we need to take ownership of and address. So in-group politics, in-group dynamics of microviolence, boundary maintenance, right, excommunication, and shaming. Then that leads to the creation of sort of a dissident, stigmatized group
who appealed to the outside world, you know, the whole revelation, expose, scandal dynamic that feeds secular perceptions of LDS people and antagonism towards LDS people. And this is the cycle that I've been using to think about Mormon history and the Mormon present quite a bit. And I think Lindsay, who I love what Lindsay is doing for Sunstone. I'll never forgive her for scheduling my session against hers. Because I'd like to be there listening, because her work on polygamy is outstanding. Outstanding public history. And an essay she wrote last summer called These Men Are Not the Enemies during the build-up to Kate Kelly's excommunication really talks about this cycle in a more vernacular form, but it deserves attention. And she cites William McKinnon's essay in Utah Historical Quarterly about the Utah War, which I think also exemplifies some of these dynamics. But see, this is a different dynamic than Jean was addressing. This isn't two rival groups competing for the same outcome and therefore escalating in competition towards some form of offense. This is something much more dialectic, you know, a dynamic of identification and differentiation where there's an othering and a shaming that just keeps passing around and around and around. And I think, you know, a key component here is how this cycle escalates. And I think one of the things that's missing from progressive Mormonism right now and in this moment, which is a moment of escalation, this has been a month of escalation of this. It's been everywhere due to the courts and due to John's upcoming court and due to the statement on non-discrimination. But one thing that's missing from progressive Mormonism, I think, if we hope to be agents of transformation, is an ethic of de-escalation. Escalation is not transformative. Never. Escalation can never transform dynamics of violence, especially deeply historically embedded ones like this. As the mother of Mormon Jewish children, I found myself weeping, which I don't usually do about Israel-Palestine politics, but I found myself crying during the hostage crisis in a Paris kosher grocery store, not only because of Islamic anti-Semitism, not only because of the violence of European imperialism that has contributed to extremist movements in the Middle East and the despair of young people worldwide, but because everything about the escalation to violence empowers the least progressive, least discerning, and most violent voices on both sides of the conflict. Escalation is deeply conservative. It does not transform. Oh, let's see. No input. You remember that little circle? Try and keep it in your mind. There it is. Escalation is deeply conservative. It does not transform. And if we hope to be progressive participants in the life of the Mormon people, I believe we have an ethical obligation to opt out of this cycle and its escalation, to refuse shaming, to refuse excessive language, to recognize the microviolence in our own communities, including within Mormon progressive communities, and something Brad spoke to this morning, you know, so many factions, so much People's Front of Judea. Who knows the reference? It's the Judean people. Exactly. What if we were to refuse to escalate and be less innocent even to our own participation as progressives in this cycle? What if we refuse to be shocked when Elder Oaks says the same thing he's been saying for 5 years, which is carving out a religious freedom defense as the default resort refuge position after the failure of the Prop 8 campaign? They've been doing this for 5 years. What if we stop being surprised and stop freaking out about it? Just a thought. That not to escalate further with our shame and our hostility towards one another. Sorry, I'm a little thoughtful about that. But I'm thinking here, too, of experience that Sarah Burlingame has shared with me on the ground organizing in faith communities, including LDS communities in Wyoming, for non-discrimination and having a conversation with a well-intentioned LDS bishop who said that if he knew a family in his ward that were to kick out their gay child for being gay, he would make sure they were excommunicated. And Sarah's observation was, is there a way to redress violence without dishing out more shame and violence, without escalating this cycle? Is there a world beyond excommunication? What if excommunication stopped being part of the lexicon of the Mormon people as an acceptable redress for differentiation? Imagine that.
de-escalation, number one. Number two, I think to transform this cycle, we as progressive Mormon people need to help broaden and recenter our analytic frames for what counts as violence worth addressing. This cycle is not transformative in large part, and the essay, too, reflects how non-transformative this cycle is because it centers around the concerns of traditionally empowered white heritage Mormons in the U.S. A transformative approach to Mormon violence would draw from our historical experience and acknowledgement of our capacity for violence, and draw out a new set of specifically Mormon values for the eradication of violence in our communities. And I'm reminded of clarion calls by Gina Colvin, whose voice is such an asset to our community, that when we get caught up in these cycles of shame around first world issues, including legalization of LGBT rights that are the law in 20 countries around the world where the U.S., where the church operates without penalty, that when we get caught up in our own history in these specifically first-worlded ways, we're missing a huge part of the Mormon story, that of the millions of our brothers and sisters who live in the global South. And so I want to sort of close today by sharing some specific writing from a woman named Lonnie Went Young, who is a Mormon feminist in Samoa. And she wrote this essay, which is going to appear in our forthcoming book, Mormon Feminism, out, I hope, later this year from Oxford UP. It is in press, 40 years of essential writings, all collected in one place. And she was writing in response to the incredibly micro-violent treatment of ordained women activists. And she beautifully reframed the entire issue, and I want to share her words. Samoans are proud to tell you we're a Christian nation founded on God. Almost 40% of the country is LDS. And yet ours is a country rife with abuse. One study estimates that over 50% of women in Samoa have experienced some form of violence in their family. A disturbing survey showed that 60% of women believe that a woman deserved to be hit by her partner or his family for a number of reasons, including serving burnt food for dinner. Almost every Samoan I know has a story to tell of childhood abuse, often relayed amidst much laughter, about beatings from older cousins, parents, even teachers and pastors using brooms, metal pipes, pieces of lumber, belts, and frying pans. These are only the barest hints of a widespread and deeply ingrained attitude that sanctions and normalizes violence, particularly against women and children. Many of our LDS families are no exception to this attitude. Yes, the gospel teaches us that such behavior is wrong. Lesson manuals instruct us on how a man who holds the priesthood should behave. But as long as men continue to hold all the leadership positions at church, as long as women are told in the temple to covenant to the Lord through their husbands, as long as only men sit in judgment on a disciplinary council, making decisions about a woman's worthiness, as long as these things are the way it is in our church, then both men and women will continue to use these structures as excuses and rationalizations for abuse. Specific to Pacifica LDS women in New Zealand and Samoa, I ask, instead of official letters issued from church headquarters and read in our wards about how marriage equality is a threat to, quote, the family, where are the letters condemning violence in the home, calling on men and women to stop beating each other and their children? When the chairman for the National Council of Churches in Samoa tells women they need to make sure they bite and scratch their rapist because otherwise we will know, quote, she wanted it, where are the voices of local LDS church leaders speaking out against such harmful counsel from a spiritual leader? Samoa is in dire need of trained counselors and treatment programs. The LDS church could take the lead in this area. What if we acknowledge that our families have some serious problems and prioritize church funds to establish an agency similar to LDS Family Services here? Instead of paying to train missionaries to go convert people, let's put some of those funds into training our bishops, Relief Society presidents, and other ward leaders how to better respond to and help their congregations those in their congregations that are living in abusive families. You see how she reframes the problem of violence in a way that moves beyond this cycle, uses our ethics as a people, our teachings that make up our faith tradition, to address violence in Mormon communities in a very recentering and broadly impactful way. So I just want to close, I think, with a question that's been implicit, I know, in Amanda's presentation and in our response to a lot of these essays. And it's a question I draw from this wonderful book that I'm so glad Dan put together, of Francis Menlove's essays, which is also, I saw, right out on the signature table. So don't miss this book.
And Frances, who was one of the founder, the only woman founder of Dialogue, which I hope you subscribe to, which you should subscribe to, says, have no doubt, in 40 or 100 years, our descendants will wince and marvel at the assumptions we now live by. Neither the church nor any one of us is exempt from the sober lessons of history. Even Jesus had to remember this. And she gives an example of revisions that Christ made to his own theology about the gospel being for Jews only versus Jews and Gentiles during his ministry. So we have nothing to be ashamed about in honest accountability for our history. But I think, you know, the important question I'd like to reflect on is what kind of topics essays will we need to write in another 100 years? Or how would the current selection of topics essays be different if Lanny Young or another Mormon woman of color were writing about violence in Mormon communities? Would we still focus on the Mountain Meadows Massacre, or would we focus on domestic violence, or maybe even on the murder of Darian Hunt, who was killed by police, an African-American man who was one of ours. He was one of ours. He was killed by police in Saratoga Springs, Utah, carrying a toy sword. He was shot. How would this essay change if women of color wrote it? This is the question I leave you with, and I look forward to a robust discussion. Thank you. I think we're supposed to sit up here now. Yes.
Yep, I've got.
Do you want to adjust those chairs?
Chairs here. Can you?
Yeah.
There's a little thing on your right hand.
Okay. Yeah. Adjust your own chair. A fascinating discussion. We will now. Yeah. Feel free to take one of these. So now we have about 20 minutes where we can dig deeper into what's going on here, and find where our own sins lie. I'm sure that's all I probably all came here, right? Find our sins. So they're just going to pass this back and forth. And first question, please. Chris.
I commend you all for investigating the issues of sort of emotional violence in the church today. But to get back to the issue of physical violence, Amanda, you commented that Mormons are not generally known for participating in mass violence. But there are statistics that show Mormons and evangelicals voting for state violence at higher rates than the general population.
Right.
So I'd like to hear your comment on that. And also, do you think the LDS Church deserves some credit for the fact that Mormons, on an interpersonal level, are not known for engaging in physical violence?
So, full disclosure, my husband is part of the U.S. military. So I come from that perspective. He's... joined the military and became a non-combatant as a physician, so it's a little different. But no, I totally agree. We are, as a people, one that tend to support war and engage in violence throughout the world, and not just in homes or, you know, throughout our communities, but actively perpetuating violence throughout the world. And I think that there's a difference, I think, between Mormons supporting secular violence or government-sponsored violence and Mormon congregations going out and killing 120 people crossing through their town. You know, and so that is, for me, where that distinction lies. But no, I mean, I completely agree. My husband's family tends to be pretty liberal, so they were very shocked when he joined the military. But his cousin is also in the Navy, and his uncle called his father. His uncle and their family are very typically conservative members of the church, and his uncle called and was like, how do I convince Colin not to go into the Navy? And my father-in-law was like, you have voted for leaders who are expanding the military. Like, you believe in this for everybody except your son. And I think that that's a conversation we should be having, is that if we're going to make these kind of things socially acceptable within Mormon communities, are we thinking about our sons and daughters who are out there now, not only perpetuating this violence, but being victims of this violence? In the military, you get $3 a day if you are in a hazard place. So you have the, it's called Hazard Pay. You get $3 a day for the added bonus of possibly being shot. And that is what, how we, you know, we vote for things like that. And I think it's something that should be discussed in our communities and should be, because, I mean, I think in general, Christ was not somebody who supported violence. So, but I agree. I think that that's, but that's where my distinction is that it's not wards or branches that are necessarily going out, but that it's culturally we support government-sponsored violence.
But ideologically, it seems like there's some overlap between the nationalistic ideology and the religious ideology. You get kind of a religious nationalism that has emerged within the church.
Right.
So in a sense, that's religious violence, when the, even when they're...
Well, and, you know, in the essay, it talks a lot about, like, the reason the Utah War happened. This isn't talked about in the essay, but the reason the Utah War happened is because the U.S. government was so worried that they were no longer part of the U.S. and they were creating this theocracy that only that we were electing religious leaders to political positions. We were doing all this. So that is not something that is new or unique to Mormonism. That, you know, it's something that is part of our history that we have very much contaminated our, you know, our political and theological beliefs.
I want to thank all of you for your thoughts. They're really interesting and informative. I tend to need to reduce an issue down to the core, and I'm interested on any of your thoughts that I keep thinking that this issue stems from the kind of the belief, well, not kind of, the belief, the true belief, or the we're right belief, or the, you know, we have all the answers. This comes from God. This is actually God telling us. And it seems that that's, in my opinion, I feel like that's at the core of this problem. And I feel like if we let go of that, then we can fix a lot of it. So how do you feel about that?
Well, I completely agree. I mean, I think that it is a big, big problem when we except that our leaders have this direct pipeline to God, and apparently we don't. And there are general authority talks that, and we had in a recent conference, two people spoke about the very same as with that Benson talk, that sort of glorifies the idea that it is the president, the prophet, that makes the decisions for the church, and that we're expected to follow. We have the right to seek counsel for our own families, but not any further, and I think that is the real issue. And maybe that's why so many, maybe why Mormons do well in military-type situations is that we are taught to follow without a lot of question. And it's too bad to think that maybe this is going to change gradually, but it's still that way.
I think that your observation about the view of Mormon leaders' infallibility and just our general hunger for servitude. The essay I pulled from Frances Menlove writing about is called Dialogue and the Lessons of History, and she talks about servitude as being so incredibly dangerous. So you might enjoy reading that essay. She's a wonderful writer and writes some very beautiful, and Dan did a great job with the book, but you know, that servitude, and she talks about actually a pre-correlation LDS worldview that was more open to ambiguity that she could remember. So it's interesting to think about the ways in which we become more certain over time, possibly, and to greater cost.
I think, too, that Mormon, that's not unique, though, in Mormon. I see it, we have a daughter who's biological daughter who has very severe medical needs, and so I participate a lot in the medical community. And I see that a lot with parents who have made life or death decisions for their children. When other people come up with that kind of thing, is the only acceptable choice is the one that they made. Because the costs are too high otherwise. Mm-hmm. because maybe you made the wrong choice, or maybe that there was another choice you could have made for your child. And I think the same thing happens in Mormonism, that when we have this, we give 10% of our tithing or of our funds, we serve, it becomes our social life and our community and everything, that if they aren't right, we have made, that cost is too high. And so I agree that we have to say that, you know, like, it might be right for you. Me providing medical care for my daughter was right for us, but maybe it's not for somebody else. And that's okay, that there are different right choices.
The lady in the middle, I'm sorry, Joanne, is that it? Joanne, I was so glad that you started out by saying that our violence was not much different than all the violence that's gone on in history. So I kind of, I'm thinking about all these different people that have had very terrible things happen to them, you know, the Jewish people, and we might say the Mormons, we definitely could say the African Americans, and I need to be convinced of what is the purpose of going back and discussing all of these absolutely terrible things that happened. For instance, Brother Thurston, your story, which was just so disturbing, that, you know, I'm one of those people that says these kind of things happen about the murder of those Paiute Indians. So I'm just curious, what's so wonderful, and you've got to go beyond just the "so it never happens again" line, what is the uplifting or positive or advancing or, you know, affirming? What is the purpose for going back and keep beating to death Mountains Meadow Massacre and that story that you told and all of these other things? I mean, it went on everywhere for just about everybody, so I convince me that we just need to keep talking about those things. There you go.
I'm writing a book on the LDS Church in Nazi Germany. Okay. And they were pretty good collaborators. And so I guess I'm prepared for those kinds of questions that are going to come up. Why don't we just let this go? With regard to the Mountain Meadows Massacre, the first significant book was written by Juanita Brooks. And she didn't go as far as Will Bagley did in saying that Brigham Young did it or ordered it. She did not conclude that. Mm-hmm. But she did conclude that Brigham Young was an accessory after the fact. And so
great.
To try to answer your question on that.
I
think we all have to be very careful that by sweeping these things under the rug, that we don't become accessories after the fact with regard to violence that occur in our society and more closely within our Mormon society.
So is your question about the value of understanding history?
Kind of, maybe more just the constant regurgitation of our negative history. If I may be so specific.
So do you feel that the difficult and violent aspects of Mormon history are constantly regurgitated? If that's your word, do you feel that regurgitated?
Somewhat, yes. Among certain crowds, it seems to be
which certain crowds?
The Sunstone crowd.
So
you're really going to pin me down, but I'll answer.
But this is an important dialogue.
Okay.
So go ahead.
Okay.
So you feel that that a sector of Mormonism, a small independent sector of Mormonism, is preoccupied with negative aspects of LDS history?
I don't know if I'd go that far, but all wants to remind us more often than faithful Latter-day Saints that they feel like are ignoring. Somehow they have the idea that we are ignoring or denying our past.
So let me show you something and see if you recognize this.
Great. So, no, just, and not to put you on the spot, but I'm trying to, the reason I want to analyze things is because I think they still really matter, and okay. they shape my everyday life.
Great.
And I feel like you and I are engaging in something that, oh, never mind.
You just got to push that.
I got to push this thing.
Just, that one or the one above it?
Push it. You're good.
All right, so there's this cycle that I've been trying to look at and think about in our history, in which when LDS people feel threatened, we double down and retrench, and then we... And then,
yes, I remember your cycle. Yes.
Right, and I feel like we're in that conversation right now. Does that feel familiar to you?
Possibly. Yeah, we're certainly on the edge of it. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's hard, right? It's very uncomfortable because clearly you care a lot about our faith, about Mormonism.
Obviously. And I admit that we have a glorious, imperfect past, like most everybody else.
Right.
Catholics?
Yeah.
Can we go there?
Well, like everybody, you know, this is our conversation. About
right,
it.
Okay. So I want to know, you know, what, it just, it's just...
Because I think this is...
What is there some... positive, affirming, faith-affirming, lovely thing that is, you know, that is accomplished by studying, repeating, digging into. I read books.
But look at me because we're talking.
Okay.
Because I do feel like
is there something I believe in?
Right.
In positivity in life and moving forward and progressing right. And love and forgiveness and
right.
And so
you're very concerned about the work those of us who do look at difficult aspects of Mormonism are doing.
Seems to be maybe bigger than it should be in the context of all of the good that
yeah.
you know they anybody that wants to convince you of our terrible past will really go for it.
So let me share with you my concern. One of the reasons
okay.
I do this work. And I'm not someone who writes excessively about Mormon histories. One that I feel like I was raised in this cycle.
Uh-huh.
And I was raised in a racist culture.
Okay.
As Mormonism.
Somewhat, me too.
We were raised in a racist Mormon culture that segregated our priesthood and temple access. And I need to understand that's a form of violence.
Uh-huh.
And it's taken 30 or 40 years for me to sort through the racism of my upbringing in American society and in Mormon society, but it's work I need to do in order to live the highest version of what I think Mormonism is really about. Does that make sense?
Sure.
That I think our racism was a problem. It was theologically unsound, and it was an embarrassment, and I want to live in right relationship to the other people
uh-huh.
of color, and so that's my hope.
And you go one step further, and thank heaven it has been corrected.
Well, and thank heaven the policy has been adjusted, but I believe that since we're raised in these cycles and deep patterns,
yes.
we have work to do to unearth them. So I see it as my work
okay.
that I need to
working
understand.
On yourself.
Absolutely, as a
okay.
Mormon person.
Okay.
And when I see around me a culture that does not talk about our racism at all in official settings, see, and
okay.
that where it's not ever, how can I learn about my work I have to do living in right relationship to people of color if there's nowhere to talk about it? If you're shamed about it at church, this is not abstract. So I'm as invested as you are, right? You're invested in the life of the Mormon people, yes?
Uh-huh.
You believe that this people, we've done wonderful things, right?
And bad things.
And bad things. And where can we talk about to do our work to escape these cycles that are not good for us.
Right.
Because the reason this essay existed is because we didn't talk about it, right? We hid it because they made us feel miserable about ourselves, right?
Yeah.
And so they used our history to embarrass us.
Uh-huh.
And
uh-huh.
we got defensive, right? You know what that defensiveness feels
probably.
Like, right?
But I know why it's not discussed in church and stuff like you're talking about. Because it's not uplifting.
Well,
it's not...
But there's, and I appreciate
it's
the
got nothing
I
lovely...
But what we have a
good
thing,
report of praise,
but we have also, I know, but is it a good report to strive to be peaceful people?
Absolutely.
Okay, so that's the hope, and sometimes that's uncomfortable work, and I thank you because you hung in there with me. You came to this space where you knew people would be discussing negative things, and you're worried about that, and you had a dialogue with me in front of a room full of people, and we made a little peace, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay. And that was hard, right?
Thank you.
I think, too, it needs to be said that not everybody in our church has the benefit of living past those moments. There are minorities in our church who still experience violence and who still have those that narrative. And that is why we discuss it, because maybe for me, as a white girl from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, that's not my narrative, you know. But it is for too many people in our church.
Okay.
And that is where it's my responsibility to say something, because those who are still in that cycle and who still have that, they deserve to have a voice and they deserve to have that discussion.
Please add something, Brother Thurston, because it was your story that was so terrible.
Well, I don't think I could be nearly as fluent or apologetic as my sister next to me. For me, it is very personal, because these are my ancestors.
Great-grandfather, yep.
They lived through these things. And I think it's important to understand our ancestors. I hope that my descendants understand me.
Mm-hmm.
I'm discussing with my ancestor because he himself didn't write anything about this or anything else for that matter.
Okay.
That I can understand and have part of my heritage. What was his role in that? Was he one of the ones that argued against it? Was he one of the ones that argued for it? I'm curious. I love history.
Yeah,
I don't care. If it's uplifting, I don't care if it's downlifting.
Uh-huh.
I want to know what happened. I think truth is beautiful, and I want truth.
That's great.
That's my personal answer.
Thank you.
All right, we've come to the end. Please give our panelists a round of applause. And now we're going to have an hour and a half to discuss this further. Please choose your favorite panelists and pay for their lunch.